Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The core question posed by business columnist Rana Faruhar in her new book is this: is Wall Street threatening to the American dream? Well, according to Faruhar, the answer is yes. She writes that Wall Street and its increasing power over Main Street interests represents the financialization of America. And then she goes a step farther. She says that the financial sector is so powerful that even the way it thinks has come to dominate American life. For example, why do we call it human capital or social capital after all? So we're also wondering, what is the consequence of all this? Well, that's the other question that Faruhar seeks to answer in her new book. It's titled Makers and Takers, The Rise of Finance and the Fall of American Business. And Rana Faruhar joins us now. She's a business columnist at Time Magazine and CNN's global economic analyst. She's in New York today. Rana, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So there's so much to dig into your book about why you think the relationship between Wall Street and Main Street is fundamentally broken. But before we do that, I actually wanted to step back and get a sense from you of how that relationship is supposed to work in your mind. You know, 100 years ago, what was that relationship supposed to be like?
Well, if you think about what the financial system was really set up to do, you know, what Adam Smith, the father of modern capitalism, thought it was supposed to do, financial institutions were supposed to take our money, all of our savings in the form of deposits, and then lend them out to businesses, to new startups, to the manufacturing company in the Midwest, to the high-tech startup in Silicon Valley, to the hairdresser down the street. And those firms would then create real jobs and real economic growth. But if there's a killer stat in my book, I think it's the fact that a lot of deep academic research shows that only about 15% of all the financial flows coming out of U.S. Banks and financial institutions today are going to business investment. Mm-hmm. So this model, this old-fashioned, it's a wonderful life, banks are supposed to help businesses grow model, that is not happening anymore. That is a minority of what financial institutions today do.
And then the other 85% then is flowing between institutions?
Well, that other 85% is existing in a kind of a closed loop of what I called financialization. It's basically going to lend against existing assets like stocks and bonds and housing. The mortgage market is a big part of this, but the mortgage market is highly financialized in the sense that mortgages can be, even today after the subprime crisis, spliced and diced. The commercial mortgage market is highly leveraged. There's a lot of debt. There's actually a bubble in that market right now. So much of what this other 85% of capital is doing is not as socially productive as this original model of banks lending to business and business then growing the economy.
Was it ever, truly as simple as that, though? Because I can imagine a lot of people hearing this might say, you know, there's always been secondary and tertiary markets. They may be more complex now, for sure. But the idea of those secondary markets spreading risk around so that those direct investments aren't as risky to take by the financial sector have always been an important part of capitalism.
Yeah. Two things. First of all, those secondary markets dramatically increased from the 1980s onwards. I'm talking exponential increase in the securities portion of the business versus the plain vanilla lending part of the business. And we can come back to that. But yeah, you're right. I mean, there have always been things like ways to spread risk. There have been options on olive presses since the ancient Greeks time, you know. So yes, there's part of that. But actually, one of the my favorite chapters in the book looks at how those secondary markets have become more and more detached from the underlying assets that they're supposed to secure. So if you look, for example, at how volatile the oil markets have been recently, we've just come through several years of record oil prices and then very low prices. The markets plunged a while back, and many economies are suffering as a result. One of the big reasons for that is that a lot of money in the oil markets has nothing to do with buying oil or even insuring the oil and other commodities that you might actually own if you're, say, a transport company or if you're a farmer. It's about trading. And you can see the size of the derivatives market that secondary market you're talking about is multiple times the size of the actual underlying asset market, which to me just shows how disconnected the financial world has become from Main Street.
Right. And then at the same time, how enormous it's become, right? Because in your
book
you write about how the financial sector takes, what, a quarter of all U.S. corporate profits now?
Yeah, and, you know, this gets back to that tension point between finance and business. You know, we often speak about the rise of Wall Street as a social issue, but actually I see it as very much an economic issue. Finance creates 4% of all American jobs. It takes 25% of all American corporate profits. So that is a lot of economic oxygen being sucked out of the room by one industry.
Mm. But on that point, I fear that by the end of this conversation, listeners are going to think that I'm a champion for an unregulated financial industry. That's not necessarily the case, but I am providing reason pushback here.
Absolutely.
Because, you know, I was thinking that when it comes to job creation, though, that the bulk of job creation in the United States has largely historically come from small businesses. So is why it's not that big of a deal that even though corporate companies are taking a lot of the profit, they're not creating as many jobs?
Oh, but it is a big deal because who do you think that really needs that bank lending? It's small and mid-sized businesses. Big business doesn't really need capital at this stage. And we can come back to that issue because the fact that many big corporations like Apple are more involved in the capital markets at a time when they don't actually need any capital is another part of the problem. But going back to the issue of small businesses, one of the things that has been so devastating in the wake of 2008 is that the small and mid-sized businesses got incredibly hurt by the fact that the bank lending really, really tightened up. Banks are not all that interested in lending anymore. It's just not that profitable for them. You know, trading, working in secondary markets, hedging, all this stuff is much, much more profitable, doing big deals, mergers. And, you know, you can see that in the shape of the industry and the fact that only 15% of the money goes to any business. And the bulk of that is really needed by small business, which is why you see lower rates of entrepreneurship, lower rates of startups. And those two things are very much correlated with the rise of finance. As finance rises from the 80s onward, you see new business creation going down, flattening, and then dropping in the U.S.
Huh. Okay. So there's a lot more to dig into, and I want to in just a second. But let's get to the heart of what you write about in the book. I mean, the subtitle is The Rise of Finance and the Fall of American Business. I mean, you describe, you know, as we've been talking about, what you see as the financialization of America. And then you say that the U.S. system of market capitalism today is broken. So prove it. tell me how you think it's broken.
Well, you know, frankly, when I look at a system where only 15% of the money is being invested in business and 85% of it is going to bid up existing assets, and I think about the fact that 10% of America owns 80% of that asset base, I think that's a pretty broken system. And I think that you can track the rise of inequality very closely to the rise of finance. There's also, by the way, any number of deep long-term studies that have been done by, you know, fairly finance-friendly places like the IMF, the World Bank, the BIS, that have found that when finance gets too big, productivity slows. Productivity is an important component of economic growth, so economic growth slows. And that effect starts to kick in when finance is half the size of what it is in the U.S. So frankly, there's little statistical doubt of what I'm saying. The thing that's a little harder sometimes for people to really get their brains around is that this is an ecosystem. Mm-hmm. I'm not talking just about too big to fail banks. I'm not just talking about giant private equity firms. I'm talking about a tax policy in this country that supports debt, which is the lifeblood of finance, rather than savings and equity. I'm talking about a housing policy that allows asset bubbles to occur but leaves a lot of people unable to get into the housing market. I'm talking about a retirement system in which 30 to 60% of our nest eggs are being eaten up by high fees of funds that don't even outperform the market. So this is a huge ecosystem. It's a process that has been happening over 40 years, and there's not a single silver bullet answer to it because it's been a long, slow, multifaceted process.
Well, we're speaking with Rana Farrukhar. She's a business columnist at Time Magazine and CNN's global economic analyst. Her new book is Makers and Takers, The Rise of Finance and the Fall of American Business. And listeners, I'm wondering what you think. Do you see what Rana Farrukhar says? Do you see it in your daily life? Do you think the financialization of America has been overall a good or a bad thing for America? I mean, we saw what happened in 2008, but on the other hand, could the modern American economy? Could the global economy function without the financial sector as it is today? Give us a call with your thoughts at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Rana also has a special chapter about MBAs, and I'm sure there's quite a few MBA listeners out there. Let us know what you think about if what you're learning at business school is good for the American economy. We're at 800-423-8255, and you can also find us at Twitter at Radio Boston. Rana, I did a great deal of reading and preparation. I was thinking about conversations that I've had with very high place folks in the finance sector over the past many years, and a lot of them have told us repeatedly that, yes, okay, 2008 was bad. It was the nadir of the American economy in recent memory. But on the other hand, they say, look, the way the global economy is today, it's of such complexity and sophistication that the financial sector needs to be equally complex and sophisticated to support it. You laugh. The former chair of Bank of America told me this just a couple months ago.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. That I actually have a chapter in my book on that sort of what I call cognitive capture. You know, we've basically been sold a line that the financial system is different than other businesses. You know, that's why the financial system has to work with 90% debt and only 5% of its own money. I mean, think about it. Would any other business, any other industry you know, be working on a daily basis with 90% debt? No. But the financial industry has convinced, in part because it holds so much power over business and also over Washington, which we can get to, it's convinced everybody that it's very special and it should be treated in all sorts of special ways. That's bunk, to be honest. That's ridiculous. And a lot of highly placed people in the financial industry would be the first ones to admit it. One of the things actually I've been fascinated by as I've put my book out there is that aside from the biggest banks, which, you know, frankly have everything invested in keeping the model as it is, a lot of very high-profile hedge funders, private equity folks, intellectual financiers that think deeply about the markets and about risk have called me and said, you know, this is an interesting argument. This is a real growth problem. And what's fascinating is these guys are the great white sharks of capitalism. I mean, they are constantly roaming and looking for the angle and looking for the trade. They know that because of 40 years of financialization eroding underlying growth, that we are entering a period of longer-term lower returns in the market, and they've gotten very concerned about it. You know, the concern is in London, it's in Silicon Valley, it's in New York, and I think in a way that's good. It's a kind of a self-interested tipping point that may get more people talking about the problem.
Huh. Okay, well, if what the former chair of Bank of America told me made you laugh, this next piece of tape will probably make you laugh too, but I want to play it anyway because it's from an ad campaign that Goldman Sachs has been putting out there for a while now, basically trying to communicate to people why and how they do, why they believe it's so important. And we have a clip here from the ad campaign, and the narrator is talking about how Goldman Sachs helped financing a public waterworks project in Washington, D.C.
The Clean Rivers Project, our deep tunneling program, is the largest capital project that D.C. Water will ever do. I would say the single biggest challenge is finance, not engineering.
We worked very collaboratively with Goldman Sachs to craft a solution that was unique in meeting D.C. Water's needs.
They wanted to think about ways of financing what is a $2.6 billion project in a way that is fair for all parties involved.
So, Ron, I mean, earlier you definitely pointed out accurately that credit has been tight for smaller businesses. But, I mean, many would say that the financial sector or the financialization of America is what may provide the instruments to do this kind of large scale investment. And that's important.
Of course it's important, but it's a fraction of what the financial system is doing. I mean, I'd be curious to know what the dollar figure on that project was. It sounds like a great project. But believe me, I'm willing to take an educated guess right now that is a tiny fraction of what Goldman Sachs did with its capital flows last year, believe me. Meanwhile, you've got this entire portion of the sector that has a really growth-degrading, inequality-increasing effect. And what I'm saying is, awesome. Let's have more projects like that. The problem is that's not where Goldman Sachs makes its money. But again, this is a larger problem because actually many of the big banks, Goldman, JP, Citibank, have been somewhat regulated since Dodd-Frank, and so some of the risk has flowed from the formal banking sector into other places, into hedge funds, into the shadow banking sector,
right.
even into the corporate bond sector, which is interesting. So you've now got big tech firms like Apple underwriting corporate bonds in the way that Goldman Sachs might have in the past, but they're not regulated like Goldman Sachs. So when I speak about finance, I'm speaking about an entire ecosystem of moving money around in ways that does not really enrich the underlying Main Street economy. And by the way, another great stat in the book is that since the 1980s, corporations of all kinds in all industries get five times as much of their revenue from financial activities. So, you know, be it an airline getting into the oil speculation business or a big tech firm underwriting bonds or GE until recently being a too-big-to-fail bank, it's as though we've all become bankers now, and I think it's eroding national competitiveness.
Well, you write specifically about another example of that. You mentioned it a couple times, but I'd love if you could tell us the deeper story about Apple and it's
yeah.
taking on debt when it has, you know, more than $100 billion in cash offshore.
Yeah. So this is – I picked this story because I think it really sharply illustrates this, the very Kafkaesque nature of the markets today, where you have Apple, one of the richest, most successful companies in history. They've got about $200 billion of cash sitting in bank accounts, many of them offshore because they don't want to pay the U.S. corporate tax rate here, which is high relative to other countries. You can actually have a whole other conversation about whether that's fair,
yeah,
given the U.S. government. National, you know, DARPA and Defense Department research is the reason that many of their products exist, but we'll save that for another show. So instead of pulling that money and bringing it back home, they've actually been issuing, over the last several years, billions and billions of dollars worth of debt. Now, what are they doing with that debt? They're not using it to build new factories in the U.S. or raise worker pay or create some kind of new moonshot R&D project to come up with the new thing. They are using it to buy back their own shares on the open market, which artificially jacks up the share price of the stock. Now, why are they doing that? Because they've been under pressure from activist investors and from shareholders that are demanding quarter by quarter that the stock go higher and higher and higher. And this illustrates how much pressure public companies are under from Wall Street all the time. They can't breathe. They have to deliver a higher share price and more profits every quarter, or Carl Icahn will start tweeting that, you know, they need to raise more money and pay back more dividends and buy back more stock. And, you know, it's just this vicious cycle. And one thing that's very interesting, as part of the research for the book, I looked at the difference in behavior between private companies and public companies.
Mm-hmm.
And here's a fascinating fact, which is that private companies in America, when you look kind of apples to apples at private companies of the same size and type of public companies, they invest about twice as much in their local economic ecosystems, new factory, worker training, R&D, as public companies do. Why is that? Because they don't have the pressure from Wall Street. They can take a longer view. They don't have to just cough up more and more and more each quarter, whether or not it's in their own best interest. And I think that that's a huge, huge problem.
Well, Rana Faruhar is author of Makers and Takers, The Rise of Finance and the Fall of American Business. We're talking to her about what she sees as the financialization of America. And Rana, I love to talk solutions as well. And even though I take your point that, like, we didn't just arrive here by magic, there's not going to be one silver bullet. There's been a 40-year march to where we have arrived, which, by the way, encompasses both Republican and Democratic administrations in the White
mm-hmm,
House.
For sure, for sure.
You know, the kind of wonky part of me wants to just take this apart a little bit by bit. And let's just start with where you mm-hmm. left off. Like, companies are issuing debt because that's mm-hmm. that's more financially advantageous to them than doing equity issues and just literally mm-hmm. selling their shares like they're supposed to back in the good old days. I mean, there are tax fixes for that, right?
Well, there are. I mean, there's a lot of low-hanging fruit in the tax code for sure. I think that we definitely need to think about a tax code that does more to subsidize investment and savings and the funneling of capital into really productive, socially useful causes, rather than subsidizing debt at both the consumer level and the corporate level. And by the way, one of the reasons that Americans have so much debt, and that's risen exponentially since the 80s as well, is that finance and credit has been used as a kind of a palliative to paper over stagnant wages and slower growth. So we come to rely more and more on debt. I mean, just look at the amount of not just credit card debt, but student debt out there is just unbelievable right now. And, you know, this really reflects the fact that there is a weakness, a sickness in the underlying economy, and it's being masked by finance.
So, I mean, would you support the idea of, say, reducing what many people see as the double taxation on equity?
Yeah, I think that we should start looking at that. Now, I want to be clear and say that, again, this isn't a silver bullet thing. If you're going to change, do a seismic shift from debt to equity in the tax code, there would be other unintended consequences, and you would have to look at those. But there's some low-hanging fruit. I mean, think about something like the mortgage interest deduction that mm-hmm. allows people to write off the mortgage interest on their home loans on their taxes. Well, you can see that, you know, it's not a bad idea to subsidize homeownership, but today the majority of that huge tax break goes to upper middle class people and helps them buy McMansions. We don't need it. It's not helping. It's, you know, creating asset bubbles in places like Boston and Brooklyn and Silicon Valley and making it impossible for millennials to get on the housing ladder.
Politically impossible, though, right? I mean, like the mortgage tax, that's a third rail.
It's been a third rail, but you know what? If we start to talk about it in the context of, you know, right now, if you don't have 30% cash down and a credit record of 750, which, by the way, most Americans have 700 or under, you're not getting a mortgage. So the system is so broken that I think we're actually, in a way, at a tipping point where we can start to have conversations that might previously have been third rail.
Hmm. So where else do you see that there are, whether small or large, policy fixes that can help undo what you've called the financialization of America?
Well, so, you know, one of the reasons I was laughing when you mentioned the quote from the Bank of America CEO is there's still plenty of complexity in the system, but there doesn't have to be. The CFTC, which is the regulator of the commodities markets, tried to do quite a lot in the wake of the financial crisis to open up and make very transparent the derivatives markets. Derivatives are those weapons of mass financial destruction that caused the 2008 crisis. And Gary Gensler, who's now Hillary's finance campaign manager, was really seminal and did so much in that area. But he and others were really pushed by this headwind of the financial lobby. And the financial lobby, which is regularly one of the top two or three donors to Washington, and in fact, in this election cycle, six out of the top 10 individual donors are hedge funders, that financial lobby pushed back and created so many loopholes in the regulation that about half the market is still impossible to see. So, you know, what argument can anyone make that it should be impossible for anyone, regulators, the public, banks themselves, other traders, to see who's trying to insure what products and for why? What social value does that have? None. It only makes money for the people who can maneuver in these sort of dark pools of capital. So that would be another area to tackle.
Hmm. Well, finally, Rana, I mean, in your book, you tie together some of the really big challenges that America's facing today. Income inequality, housing we've talked about, supporting businesses, creating an economy that actually makes things. You know, these are really big and important issues that people are thinking about, perhaps this year more actively than in the past, mm-hmm. given the presidential mm-hmm. cycle. But we saw a review in the Wall Street Journal of your book, and it's from the head of the Harvard Business School, mm-hmm. and he writes that many of the alleged consequences of financialization, such as the decline of manufacturing, while maybe true, they are the result of dozens of forces, many that have a little to do with finance. So that's the mm-hmm. pushback from Harvard Business School, and I'm wondering what you think about that.
Yes, I actually have a letter coming out in the journal myself rebutting the points he made. But I actually respect Dean Norrie a lot. I interviewed him for this book, and I was interested. I mean, I think that he's concerned about these issues as well. It's true that there are sort of three trends, big meta trends in the economy, globalization, financialization, and technological-related job destruction that work in sync, but they also strengthen one another. And in fact, we just don't have a finance system of the kind that the Dean was sort of romanticizing, plain vanilla lending. Yeah. As I said, it's a small part of what it does. So we really need to get back to that.
Well, Rana Faruhar's new book is Makers and Takers, The Rise of Finance and the Fall of American Business. It's been a great pleasure to speak with you, Rana. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Let us know what you think at radioboston.org. And that's it for today on the air. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.